Now there's a flash packet of fame. She hails from New York and the dreadnought's her name. She's bound to the westward where the stormy winds blow. Bound away in the dreadnought to the westward we'll go. Daddy down, 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 daddy down. Now the dreadnought, she lies in the River Mersey, awaiting the tugboat to take her to sea. Far around that rock light where the salty tides flow, bound away to the westward, and the dreadnought will go. Daddy down, 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 daddy down. Now the dreadnought's a howling down the wild Irish Sea, her passengers merry with hearts full of glee. Her sailors like lions walk the decks to and fro. She's the Liverpool packet, oh Lord, let her go.
Welcome to Truth Jihad Radio. I'm your host Kevin Barrett, bringing you great guests, telling you all sorts of amazing truths rarely heard in the mainstream, and also correcting the illusions and fictions, downright lies, that they're telling us about history as well as about what's going on today. And the more we learn about history, the more we see that they just keep using the same old tricks, the same old false flags and deceptions. The same groups are still running things. The banksters who took over in 1913 with the Federal Reserve coup d'etat and then reaffirmed their rule in 1963 with the JFK coup d'etat, and then did it again on 9/11, are obviously still in charge. Well, let's look back a little bit at history. This Thursday, we're coming up on the anniversary of the Lusitania incident. This was a huge media event that was used to prep the American public for entry into a war that they had absolutely no business fighting. That is World War I. There was no reason whatsoever for the U.S. to even get involved in World War I. Yet, with a carefully orchestrated propaganda campaign, the people soon were clamoring for war. How do they do it? Who did it and why? Well, we're going to talk with the all-around expert in all things New World Order, James Perloff. James Perloff has written some great books, including even bestsellers, exposing the truth about what's really going on with our bankster-ruled system. And there's nobody better than him for this, so let's bring it on. James Perloff, how are you?
Very good, Kevin, but you might be the best all-round expert on false flags and what the banksters are doing, but happy to share with you some material on the Lusitania, whose 100th anniversary is this week.
Yeah, that's pretty exciting, and it's, you know, it's such a classic case of the huge photogenic disaster, all these deaths, screaming headlines, people clamoring for war. This kind of seems like it's happened more than once.
Oh, you think so? Oh, I thought this was kind of a unique, I thought this was kind of a unique one-time, one-shot event in history that never got repeated.
Yeah, I wish. I mean, if we could catch on to these people and get the word out in a big enough way, maybe we could slow them down and stop it from happening so often. But that's what we're trying to do here at Truth Jihad Radio. So let's talk a little bit about the background to the Lusitania. That was a huge passenger ship, and it departed from New York for Liverpool on May Day, 1915, and there were some problems already visible on the horizon when it left.
Yes, and it was torpedoed. Just to give people the background, the context of this event, Kevin, was that World War I was in progress. It had begun, of course, in 1914 following the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand, which followed the creation of the Federal Reserve. And at that time, 1915, when the Lusitania sailed, the powers of Europe were embroiled in war. You had the Central Powers with Germany, Austria-Hungary, and the Ottoman Empire fighting against the allies of England, France, Russia, and Serbia. And America was not yet involved, but it was about to be. The Lusitania was torpedoed on May the 7th, 1915. Single torpedo struck it from a German U-boat in the South Irish Sea. After the torpedo hit, a few seconds later, there was a massive explosion, and this gigantic ship 44,000 tons. It was actually the largest ship afloat when it was launched in 1906. That was before the Titanic had come on the scene. And it went down in just 18 minutes. But this did become, as you were pointing out, a massive basis for propaganda. And if, at my website, jamesperloff.com, I have an exhaustive post on the Lusitania. It's called False Flag at Sea. I have quite a few of the posters that were produced showing the Lusitania going down. And it says, avenge the Lusitania, enlist. When you fire, remember this. And it shows the ghost of a little girl coming up from the Lusitania. And so this is portrayed as a wanton slaughter of innocent women and children. We were minding our own business, and for no reason at all, the Germans just attacked this ship to inflict pain on the innocent. And so, well, we must go to war. And it took a while for Woodrow Wilson, who was the president of the United States at that time, to get the declaration, longer than he had anticipated. But that was the cardinal event that started the things in motion for America going into the First World War.
And many alternative researchers and historians have long known that there is this backstory to the Lusitania, that it wasn't simply evil Germans sinking a passenger liner for no reason. But it seems like very slowly this truth might be seeping into the mainstream. Even the National Review, the neocon flagship, is publishing an article from a couple of days ago by George Will, another neocon flagship, called Another Look at the Lusitania. And they're sort of doing a limited hangout and saying, well, you know, maybe we didn't work hard enough to protect it.
Yeah, that's quite an understatement. We should talk about why it was that the Germans would have sunk this ship without warning. That's very important to know the context, because it helps us to understand the kind of plotting and intrigue that went into this. When World War I began, the British began a naval blockade of Germany, and the Royal Navy was quite superior to the German Navy. And proof of that is that the German Navy never got out of the North Sea during the entire course of the war. They were hemmed in by mines and the Royal Navy. The only craft that could escape the blockade were the U-boats. Now, the British were blockading all commercial vessels trying to get to Germany. American ships trying to get in couldn't get through. And several hundred thousand Germans died from starvation due to that blockade. The German blockade of Britain, which could only be carried out by its U-boat force, was retaliatory. And I want to point out that when they started using U-boats against merchant shipping bringing supplies to Britain, the German U-boat commanders would observe what were called cruiser rules. And these were rules that had been established at international conventions like the Hague Convention, which said that if a warship attacked a merchant vessel, it must first give the crew a chance to surrender, escape in lifeboats, and then either take it as a prize or sink the ship. And so the Germans obeyed that international law, and actually of the first 25 British merchant ships they sunk, there were no loss of life at all on 20 of them. And you can actually see footage on YouTube where they were allowing the passengers to escape. So how come they torpedoed the Lusitania without warning? And the answer to that is that the British Admiralty, then headed by Winston Churchill, unilaterally broke the cruiser rules. Churchill ordered that merchantmen be armed, and he ordered them to attack any U-boat that ordered them to halt. I'm going to quote what Colin Simpson, the British historian, said, and it was really, I consider it's the definitive book on the Lusitania. There's been many books since. None have matched it. It's the critical thinker's book on the Lusitania. Colin Simpson, 1972, quoting him, he said, quote, from October 1914 onward, a steady stream of inflammatory orders were issued to the masters of British merchant ships. It was made an offense to obey a U-boat's order to halt. Instead, masters must immediately engage the enemy, either with armament if they possessed it, or by ramming if they did not. Any master who surrendered his ship was to be prosecuted, and several were, unquote. Now, I also want to quote Churchill on this, because he's the guy who made this decision. Before the Lusitania went down, he wrote to Walter Runciman, the president of the Board of Trade, quote, it is most important to attract neutral shipping to our shores in the hope of especially of embroiling the United States with Germany, and unquote. And here's what he wrote in his post-war book, The World Crisis, quote, "The maneuver which brings an ally into the field is as serviceable as that which wins a great battle. The first British countermove made on my responsibility was to arm British merchantmen to deter the U-boat from surface attack. As the U-boats were forced by the progressive arming of the British mercantile marine to rely increasingly on underwater attacks, they encountered a new set of dangers. The submerged U-boat, with its defective vision, ran the greatest risk of mistaking neutral for British vessels and thus of embroiling Germany with other great powers," unquote, Winston Churchill. So let me just explain what he means by defective vision is he'd been told by a naval advisor that it was very hard to identify the flag of a ship through a periscope. And what Churchill hoped was that sooner or later, some U-boat commander would see an American ship, I think it was British, and torpedo it. And then voila, he would have the case for America coming into the war. But the problem, Kevin, is that the U-boat commanders didn't do that. They were scrupulously avoiding attacking American ships. They did not sink one. So what does Churchill do? He goes from plan A to plan B. If they won't sink an American ship, we'll have them sink a British ship with Americans on board, which is what the case of the Lusitania. And he ordered Joseph Kenworthy of the Political Division of British Naval Intelligence to draw up a study to determine what the political impact would be of just such a sinking.
Wow, you know, that sounds a lot like some of the studies that were going on in the 1990s about the impact of Pearl Harbor on the American mind. The world's leading focus group expert worked for the U.S. military on secret studies throughout the 1990s on why Americans still hated Japan even after almost half a century. And they found that it was because Japan had violated Americans' sense of invulnerability with the Pearl Harbor surprise attack and all of these horrific images of big billowing clouds of smoke and lots of 2,000 dead people. So that's how they drew up the plan to give us big billowing clouds of smoke, pyroclastic in this case, and a couple of thousand dead people on 9/11. So it seems that they actually do studies of these kinds of mass slaughters to figure out what the public relations impact is going to be, and then they set up the slaughter.
Right. In the case of World War II, more than 80% of the people did not want to enter that war before Pearl Harbor. And what they, I think, Kevin, which they actually figured out was that it was going to take more than a Lusitania. It was going to take a bunch of Lusitanias, and that's what they got at Pearl Harbor. They knew it was going to take a massive, massive event to bring us into World War II as opposed to World War I, which had been debunked by post-war revisionist historians.
Wow. You know, the more things change, the more they stay the same. And, you know, and also I think you can analyze the similarity between Lusitania, Pearl Harbor, and 9/11 at another level, which is that each of these three events had a massive public relations impact. As you said, in World War II, rather in 1941, Pearl Harbor turned around this 80% anti-war public opinion overnight. And similar kinds of public opinion shifts were registered after the Lusitania and after 9/11. And so they do the huge event with a massive emotional impact that just blows people's minds. And then they follow it up with obviously smaller things, a series of smaller things to keep the story going. So in World War One, we got these all kinds of, you know, German atrocity stories. You just every week there would be a new German atrocity story. And in World War II, same thing. And some people would say that we're still living with some somewhat exaggerated German atrocity stories. And then with 9/11, we follow that up with Madrid, Belize, 7/7, and all onward and onward through Charlie Hebdo, and even maybe yesterday's event in Texas. So it looks like in all three of these cases, we had a huge sort of set piece public relations event, massively lethal, horrific images. And then in order to keep the war going, then they come up with you know, smaller kinds of PR images and accusations against the so-called enemy.
Exactly. Well, that reminds me, just to tie the present or recent events to the distant past, we had right after 9/11 these images allegedly of Palestinians handing out candy to children, supposedly to celebrate the deaths of all the people in the Twin Towers. And that takes you right back to World War One, when the fabricated story in the American press that the Germans had given their children a holiday from school to celebrate the sinking of the Lusitania with 1,200 lost lives on board that ship.
Right, and actually an investigation by a mainstream German documentary producer found that, in fact, that footage of ostensible Palestinian celebrations on 9/11 was all bogus. That they got that partly by showing stock images of a martyr's funeral from a year or more before, and then they also apparently some film crews went out and actually handed out money and sweets to get people all excited, and then filmed them being excited. So it was all completely fraudulent. And yet, to this day, millions and millions of Americans believe that they saw Palestinians celebrating the 9/11 attacks.
Right. The false flag is staged, and then the supportive propaganda is staged as well. These guys, they must have quite a few Hollywood scriptwriters on their payroll.
Yeah, it seems like in the difference between Hollywood and journalism and history seems to have collapsed. Maybe television has helped with that process. But today, it seems like it's the Hollywood scriptwriters who are pretty much putting together the whole narrative that people are buying and believing through the media and through the academy.
I don't know if you've seen that movie called Wag the Dog, White House actually hires Hollywood to create a fictitious war in Albania to distract the American people from a sex scandal of the president right before the election. But I believe that that process is very real and really does take place. And I think that they pay big money for big talent and figure out what sort of PR will have the maximum impact on American public opinion.
Well, that's right. And of course, with events like 9/11, Lusitania, and Pearl Harbor, a whole lot of people actually die. And, you know, these are just these giant, spectacular events. As you said, the Lusitania was the biggest ship at the time it was built, and it made massive headlines, and posters were printed up, just like after Charlie Hebdo, where we had millions and millions of identical so-called protest signs, all saying, Je suis Charlie. They were all exactly the same color, font, everything, identical, millions of identical signs. Somebody spent a fortune to print those things up, millions of dollars. And likewise, after Lusitania, huge numbers of posters got printed up and newsreels. And you know, the methods, the media have changed a little bit, but the idea of mass broadcasting these atrocity images to demonize the enemy hasn't changed at all.
No, nothing's changed. Just some of the technologies have been upgraded to have an even bigger impact and a bigger reach than they did in years past.
Okay, well, let's talk a little bit more about the context here. So Churchill had been frustrated by the Germans' reluctance to sink any American ship, so he wanted to get a whole bunch of Americans onto a British ship and get that sunk. And he had his naval intelligence chief draw up a plan to see what the reaction would be. And so how did they go about orchestrating this?
Well, first of all, just as evidence that this was foreknown by the Allies, this ship was going to go down, there are some quotes I'm going to give you and our listeners. 5 days before the Lusitania sank, May 2nd, 1915, Walter Hines Page, he was the American ambassador to Great Britain. He wrote a letter to his son, and you can see this in the Life and Letters of Walter Hines Page. It's on, you can find it on archive.org online. He said this 5 days before the ship went down, quote, "If a British liner full of American passengers be blown up, what will Uncle Sam do? That's what's going to happen," unquote. Now, Kevin, this is a significant quote for two reasons. Number one, he says it's going to happen. He doesn't say it might happen. Then number two, the wording, he says a British liner will be blown up. Now, what's significant about this, he didn't say it'll be sunk. It'll be blown up, which is what did happen. And so why wouldn't you think it would just be torpedoed and gradually sunk and go down like most ships did? The other quote is from Edward Mandelhaus, and many of your listeners will know that he was the Wall Street controller of President Woodrow Wilson. He handpicked his cabinet, and a very powerful man, and he was in Britain at the time. And on the day the Lusitania sunk, that morning he met with Edward Grey, the British foreign minister, and I have some quotes from him, and these are taken from the intimate papers of Colonel House. It's his biography, is published by Charles Seymour, edited by Charles Seymour, Skull and Bones. House said this, speaking of his conversation with Foreign Minister Gray, quote, "We spoke of the probability of an ocean liner being sunk, and I told him if this were done, a flame of indignation would sweep across America, which would in itself probably carry us into the war," unquote. Now, Kevin, later that day, House and Gray traveled to Buckingham Palace, and they met with King George V. Now, here's another quote from Edward Mandell House, quote, "We fell to talking, strangely enough, of the probability of Germany sinking a transatlantic liner. He," meaning the king, "said, suppose they should sink the Lusitania with American passengers on board," unquote. Now, Kevin, this is a couple of hours before the Lusitania was sunk. It's obviously on the minds of all these hires up that this event is about to happen. So you know that there is foreknowledge of this event. And
well, you know, that's another interesting kind of comparison to 9/11, because our current Secretary of Defense, Ash Carter, and Philip Zelikow, the man who wrote the whole 9/11 Commission report in chapter-by-chapter outline before the commission had even convened, wrote an article for Foreign Affairs Magazine, the flagship of Council on Foreign Relations, in 1998, speculating on the likely political, psychological, and cultural consequences of a massive Pearl Harbor-style event such as the destruction of the World Trade Center. So it's amazing how these guys, you know, can see straight into the future with their crystal balls.
Yeah, isn't it amazing that just by sheer guesswork they could know something like that could possibly happen? Well, the Lusitania, we should also talk about why it was a legitimate target. I mean, even if it went down, why would the Germans want to torpedo a passenger ship? And the answer to that, Kevin, is that the Lusitania was making monthly cruises back and forth between America and Britain. It had been built with subsidies from the British government, and actually got subsidies even for its annual operational costs, with a stipulation that if war broke out, that the ship would be refitted as an auxiliary cruiser when fall under the authority of the Royal Navy, and that's what happened. And so prior to its sinking, it had made several trips back and forth between America ferrying munitions. Now, when it went to the west, to America, it could bring, you know, any kind of commercial goods, but it went back east towards Britain. It was under the direct authority of the naval officers, Royal Naval officers in America, and they had top priority of what went on into the cargo hold of Lusitania, and it was ferrying munitions back and forth. And on the actual voyage, when it was sunk, it had on board 173 tons of rifle cartridges, more than 50 tons of shrapnel shells, 46 tons of aluminum powder, which was an explosive that the British used in at their Woolwich arsenal for the making of shells and such. And it also had an unknown quantity, but we know a large quantity, it was unknown because it was disguised on the manifest, of gun cotton, which they used in large caliber shells and in their sea mines. And on top of that, they had 18 cases of percussion fuses containing mercury fulminate, which is also very explosive. And so it's no mystery that what caused the explosion was detonation of these munitions a matter of seconds after the torpedo hit. And it did hit in the forward cargo hold where these munitions were kept. Now, the British tried to make it sound like it was a boiler that had exploded, and they tried to exaggerate the number of torpedoes, but we know for a fact from the ship's logbook and the testimony of the lookouts on the Lusitania, as well as conversations with the survivors of the U-20, the U-boat, there was just one torpedo fired. And we know it was not a boiler room exploding, because sailors survived from all three operational boiler rooms. That's not what blew up. Not one sailor survived from over the cargo area. That's what blew up, and that's where the munitions were. So this was the reason that the Germans sank the ship, was that they did not want these a couple hundred tons or 300 tons of munitions reaching the front lines where they would kill German soldiers. What the British were doing was trying to protect these munitions shipments with women and children, and daring the Germans to come on and sink them. The Germans did everything they could, Kevin, to prevent passengers from getting on board this ship. And as you probably have heard, they took out, tried to take out a notice in the American newspapers to warn American passengers not to board the Lusitania. Here's the notice. I'll quote it. It says, "Notice, in large letters, travelers intending to embark on the Atlantic voyage are reminded that a state of war exists between Germany and Great Britain, and that the zone of war includes the waters adjacent to the British Isles, and that in accordance with formal notice given by the Imperial German government, vessels flying the flag of Great Britain are liable to destruction in those waters, and that travelers sailing in the war zone on ships of Great Britain do so at their own risk, signed the Imperial German Embassy," unquote. Now, the State Department, an officer there, ordered this public, this notice, which was supposed to appear in 15 newspapers near the Cunard, sailing notices, Cunard, which owned the Lusitania, was supposed to be published, but it was suppressed. And when the Germans found out, they sent a representative to the State Department who spoke to William Jennings Bryan, an honest Secretary of State. When he learned of this, he immediately cleared the publication for of this notice for publication, but now it's getting late. And he asked Woodrow Wilson, "Would you please tell Americans not to board the Lusitania?" Woodrow Wilson refused to do so because he was on the banker's puppet strings. But this was a legitimate target. The Germans did everything they could to keep Americans off of it.
So William Jennings Bryan was an honest broker at that point. Is there anybody comparable to that today, do you think, in the halls of power?
No. The only reason that... No, the only reason he got to be Secretary of State, and he was a man of integrity, even if he was faulted, he'd been more than once the Democratic Party's candidate for president. And when the banksters moved to make Wilson president in 1912, they had to secure his cooperation. The trade-off was that he got to be Secretary of State. But I should mention that Wilson tried to maneuver the sinking of the Lusitania into an immediate declaration of war and rupture of relations with Germany, and sent an ultimatum to the Germans demanding that they halt all submarine warfare, which they couldn't, of course. It was the only means of retaliation they had, was their U-boat against Britain. And so the Germans replied, and they said that their reply said that they would make good any loss of life, I mean, compensate for it to America. They would also, they also provided Wilson with photostatic copies of Winston Churchill's orders to merchantmen to attack U-boats, which one of the U-boat commanders had found on a captured merchant vessel. And they also pointed out that this was an auxiliary cruiser of the British Navy, and that it was armed and that it was carrying munitions. So that was no basis for a declaration of war. So Woodrow Wilson then sent a reply, and this is where Bryan comes in. He wanted a reply sent to the Germans saying, quote, "The United States has enforced its statutes with scrupulous vigilance through its regularly constituted officials and is therefore able to assure the Imperial German government that it is misinformed," end quote. Well, William Jennings Bryan was asked to sign this as Secretary of State. He refused to do so, and he resigned as Secretary of State at that point because he was sick and tired of Wilson's duplicity, of his constant double standard of tolerating Britain breaking the cruiser rules, but having zero tolerance for Germany's breaking the cruiser rules in retaliation. And he couldn't stomach it anymore, so he resigned. He was then ridiculed by the press. But the powers that be were very happy with that resignation because they were able then to put Robert Lansing in as Secretary of State. Lansing was an insider, absolutely pro-war, and he was the uncle of Allen Dulles and John Foster Dulles. And then he worked with Wilson to get that declaration of war.
Sounds like the same establishment has been in control for quite some time. Mm-hmm. What was Wilson's position with regard to this establishment? Obviously, he was largely its tool. But there are these, you know, you see quotes from Wilson saying something like, you know, there's a secret power and men are so afraid mm-hmm. of it that they only speak of it under their breath and things like that, as though he himself were not completely in favor of the project of this secret cabal that was really ruling the country.
Well, that's like Hillary saying she's going to tax the top 1%, or Romney saying that he favors the middle class. You know, a campaign promises mean nothing. The background of Woodrow Wilson is this. He had graduated, I believe it was 1879, from Princeton, and he was a classmate of Cleveland Dodge, who later went on to become a big bank with National City Bank and was a major munitions dealer. And when he returned as a professor to Princeton, Cleveland Dodge and Cyrus McCormick, who was went on to found McCormick Harvester, they become trustees at Princeton, and they maneuvered him into the presidency of Princeton. And then Wilson wrote a book called The History of the American People, which was published by a J.P. Morgan company, Harper. And he was groomed to be the president. But it was, he came from, it was like Obama coming from nowhere. He had no political experience. He'd never been in Congress. To give him some legitimacy to run for president, they had him be the governor of New Jersey for 1 year. That was it. But it was the mass media magic. And the other thing they did, of course, was they pulled a trick. The Republican Party, they split the votes on the Republicans. William Howard Taft was the incumbent. The Republicans had been in office for 16 years. But the Republicans had a growing reform movement under people like Senator Robert La Follette and Charles Lindbergh, and the establishment was worried about that. They decided to go with Wilson. So to split the Republican votes, they trotted out Teddy Roosevelt and was called the Bull Moose Party, which everybody's forgotten about. But he was a former popular Republican president. So the votes in the 1912 election were split between Taft and Roosevelt, and Wilson, the Democratic candidate, got the election, won the election with only 42% of the popular vote. They snuck him in that way. And I should mention also, when Teddy Roosevelt ran as Bull Moose, he started talking about reform, which took all the power out of Robert La Follette's attempt to get the Republican nomination in 1912. He was making a bid for that. He was kind of like the Ron Paul of his day. He was really working for reform.
And he was from my home state of Wisconsin, by the way. Fighting Bob La Follette is a huge name here.
Yeah.
We have a Fighting Bob Fest every year. And the brainwashed progressives who follow the pseudo-alternative media that's foundation-funded, those type of people dominate, unfortunately, at Fighting Bob Fest. I wish that we had more real Fighting Bobs here in Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, so that's a fascinating background. And La Follette actually ended up, as I recall, didn't he face some sanctions, as it were, for opposing the war?
Yes, this is interesting. If you go online, you can actually find the entire congressional hearing where they tried to expel or impeach him from the Congress because he came out and exposed what had happened. I'm going to give you a quote from La Follette. This is from 1917, quote, he said, 4 days before the Lusitania sailed, President Wilson was warned in person by Secretary of State Bryan that the Lusitania had 6 million rounds of ammunition on board besides explosives, and that the passengers who proposed to sail on that vessel were sailing in violation of the statutes of this country, end quote. This was a big statement by La Follette, and they tried to expel him from the Congress, and the reason it didn't happen, Bob, is because ex-Secretary of State William Jennings Bryan came forward and validated what he said, and that shut their mouths up on La Follette's state in Congress. But he was one of the first truther. He was a truther, and he was trying to stop that 1917 declaration of war. He knew that there was no reason for us to go to war with Germany, and the banks just wanted him out of the way. So Fighting Bob.
Interesting, yeah. He's one of the long line of American heroes who've stood up against these false flags and unjust wars of aggression. Abraham Lincoln actually did that regarding the Mexican War, which was an orchestrated land theft operation launched by a false flag. And then here we had Fighting Bob La Follette, still one of the great political heroes in America, doing the same thing in World War One.
Yeah, sometimes they look at the Democratic system as something they control because they figure they can always, through their press ownership, get at least 51% of the vote for their candidate. But it doesn't always work, and sometimes somebody like Robert La Follette rises up, and they have to deal with him. But just to finish the conversation on the control of Wilson, if you read the book called FDR, My Exploited Father-in-Law, by Curtis Dahl, who is a syndicate manager for Lehman Brothers, he's a son-in-law of Franklin D. Roosevelt. He wrote about Wilson in that book, and he said that when before Wilson became president, he had to make a pledge to the banker Bernard Baruch, who he later appointed head of the War Industries Board, which would make billions in profits for the bankers. The four steps of the pledge were, number one, to lend an ear to advice on who should occupy his cabinet. That means let Edward Mandelhouse pick it. Number two, lend an ear to advice should war break out in Europe. And he did everything he could to get us into that war. And number three and four were to support an income tax and to support a central bank, i.e. the Federal Reserve. And if you look, the income tax and the Federal Reserve were passed in 1913. 1913 was Woodrow Wilson's first year in office. This guy did what he was told. You don't get to be president without making pledges, without selling your soul to the devil.
Interesting. You know, another comparison between the World War One situation and the time around 9/11 is that just prior to World War One, we had this orchestrated takeover by way of the Federal Reserve, the income tax. America was really restructured right before World War One. And World War One was used to kind of institutionalize this restructured America. And likewise with 9/11, during the 1990s, the NAFTA and these free trade agreements were pushed through. Neoliberalism took over. American jobs were exported. The real economy was hollowed out, and the stage was set for another push for this new world order. And then 9/11, like the Lusitania, was the public relations event that stampeded people into the war that would allow them to trash what was left of America's Republican with a small R heritage and stampede us into this new world order with reduced liberty, more government power, and the attempt of these big banksters to take over the world.
Yeah, there seem to be these pauses before they'll generate a new series of wars. I may be wrong about this, Kevin, but I noticed that the Vietnam War began in 1964 for us, big time, with the Tonkin Gulf. And that was right after television had reached the saturation point. World War II seemed to begin after the saturation point with radio getting into homes. In other words, a new tool for propagandizing the public. The war in Vietnam was called the First Television War. And it seemed that getting the home computer into everyone's home kind of preceded this onslaught of the Middle Eastern wars. I may be wrong on that, but it seems that they want to get a new technological device for propaganda and spying into your home before they start the new round of wars. I may be wrong, but...
Well, it may have backfired, because TV images didn't help the Vietnam War effort, and the internet is what allowed us to expose 9/11, so now everybody with a three-digit IQ and eyes that can open knows that 9/11 was an inside job. And likewise, during Vietnam, the whole country woke up and realized that this was evil and oppressive of the American War of Aggression. So these new media technologies, I think, have been a double-edged sword, but I think that along with the internet, James, I think that actually the spying technology may have been key to the timing of 9/11, because clearly they turned the NSA against the American people illegally 6 months before 9/11. And I think it was used to do research on every significant person, whether a person of wealth or a person with a political position, who might stand up against the coming 9/11 coup d'etat. And they dug up scandal material, blackmail material on everybody they could. They profiled all these people. The only reason I'm here doing what I'm doing now is I was way too insignificant to ever be profiled by the NSA before 9/11. But the people, who could stand up against 9/11, like Paul Wellstone, for example, I'm sure they profiled him. They knew he was incorruptible. They knew he knew 9/11 was an inside job, and so they ended up killing him. And likewise, I'm sure many, many other people. Jimmy Walter was lucky. He spent $1 million spreading 9/11 truth, and then they basically gave him enough death threats and physical attacks that he was forced to leave the country and drop his 9/11 efforts. But I think it was that spy technology that allowed them to know that they could do such a crazy really ridiculous plan as 9/11, where the left hand didn't know what the right hand was doing, and they screwed up left, right, and center. They Building 7 obviously wasn't supposed to come down at 5:20 in the afternoon for no reason. They screwed up, but they knew that they were embarking on something crazy that had all kinds of contingency plans built into it. Things were going to go wrong. It was not like they covered it up very well, but instead they knew that they could sell it by way of, number one, the shock effect that brainwashed the majority of people at the unconscious emotional level, and number two, they had this spy apparatus in place, so they'd already profiled everybody that was in a position of power to make a difference and prepared to make sure that none of those people could actually push back effectively.
Thank you, Kevin. I had not heard that perspective before about taking out some of the initial potential whistleblowers, people of position and influence. I had not heard that perspective before, but that does make sense that they wanted the technology in place to enable them to do that before 911 went down. Thank you.
Yeah, I think people need to understand that process of profiling and then deciding who is an actionable threat. And you know, anybody who's got a lot of money, a lot of power, position, the kind of people who actually, if they chose to fight back against something like 9/11, would have a chance of success. Those are the people that they worry about, and those are the people that the spy apparatus focuses on. Many of us like to imagine that we're that significant ourselves. Very few of us really are.
Getting back to the Lusitania, I should probably mention the cover-up because there's always a commission. There's a 911 commission, and there, of course, after Pearl Harbor, we've talked about Pearl Harbor. There was the Roberts Commission, where FDR scapegoated the local commanders at Pearl Harbor, Admiral Kimmel and General Short, who he had denied the foreknowledge he had of that attack. But in the case of the Lusitania, the commission is not in America. It's in Britain, of course. And what they decided to do was to scapegoat the captain of the Lusitania. And I'm just going to give you, your listeners, some quotes on that. There was a report written up by Richard Webb, who was the head of the Admiralty's Trade Division. And here's his conclusion. One, quote, "One is forced to conclude that he, Captain Turner, William Turner, the captain of the Lusitania, is either utterly incompetent or he has been gotten at by the Germans," unquote. Oh, you know what? I'm going to interrupt this. I'm sorry. I'm going to interrupt myself, Kevin, because I'm missing something. I'm missing something. Before we get to the cover-up, there's a very important couple of very important details about the sinking of the Lusitania that I didn't mention.
Okay, bring them up.
The Lusitania, it wasn't just foreknowledge in these quotations I've given you, but there was a plan. When the Lusitania arrived at the South Irish Sea, the captain was expecting that there would be a Royal Navy escort because it was known that a U-boat was in the South Irish Sea. I should mention that the British, in what they call Room 40, had cracked Germany's naval codes. And so when a U-boat would surface in 1915 and radio its home port, they could read the signal. They knew what the orders were and where it was headed. Now, in the South Irish Sea, it was too far from Germany to be transmitting radio messages, but they knew from its activity it was there. In fact, the day before it sank, the Lusitania, it sank two steamers there. So they knew that the submarine was there, and a general alert had gone out to commercial shipping that it was a submarine danger in that sea. And the Lusitania did pick up that message. Now, when the Lusitania arrived, it did not have any escort waiting for it. A cruiser called the Juno was supposed to meet it, but the Juno was recalled to the port of Queenstown on the southern coast of Ireland on the pretext that it couldn't, it was too vulnerable to submarine attack. Now, normally, the Lusitania, when there was a submarine threat in the past, had been accompanied by destroyers, and destroyers were available on May the 7th. There were four destroyers lying idle in the nearby port of Milford Haven. They were not sent to hunt the sub that had been sinking ships, nor were they sent to escort the Lusitania as was protocol. And I want to quote a couple of important authorities here from British Naval Intelligence. And the first is somebody I already referred to as Commander Joseph Kenworthy of the Political Division of British Naval Intelligence. Quote, "The Lusitania was sent at considerably reduced speed into an area where a U-boat was known to be waiting and with her escorts withdrawn," unquote. The second quote, which is even more powerful, is from Patrick Beasley in his book Room 40. Now, Patrick Beasley was an officer also in British Naval Intelligence. He is considered the leading authority on the history of British Naval Intelligence. And here's what he writes, quote, "Nothing, absolutely nothing was done to ensure the liner's safe arrival. I am reluctantly driven to the conclusion that there was a conspiracy deliberately to put the Lusitania at risk in the hopes that even an abortive attack on her would bring the United States into the war. such a conspiracy could not have been put into effect without Winston Churchill's express permission and approval, unquote, Patrick Beasley, British Naval Intelligence.
Wow, so that's a true insider whistleblower of the highest order.
Mm-hmm. He wrote that in the 1980s. He was the guy, I believe, used to actually move the pieces in the Admiralty map room where Churchill would go. They had a gigantic map which would show the positions of each hostile and friendly and British ship, and it showed the Lusitania on a direct collision course with the U-boat, the U-20, which sank her.
Wow. Very interesting.
Well, anyway, let me resume the cover-up part, because I needed to backtrack for the cover-up. So I was talking about Richard Webb, who had said that the captain was incompetent or gotten out by the Germans. This report was reviewed by Admiral Lord Fisher of the Admiralty, who said, quote, Turner, the Captain Turner, is not a fool but a knave. I feel absolutely certain that Captain Turner of the Lusitania is a scoundrel and been bribed. I hope that Captain Turner will be arrested immediately after the inquiry, whatever the verdict or finding may be, unquote. And then he added this to the report, quote, ought not Lord Mersey to get a hint, unquote. Now, Lord Mersey was the wreck commissioner who was going to oversee the hearing on the Lusitania. He's also the man who oversaw the hearing of the Titanic sinking. Churchill then reviewed this report and said, quote, we shall pursue the captain without check, unquote. And then Richard Webb then wrote directly to Lord Mersey and said, quote, I am directed by the Board of Admiralty to inform you that it is considered politically expedient that Captain Turner, the master of the Lusitania, be most prominently blamed for the disaster, unquote. So, Kevin, Lord Mersey is told before the inquiry even begins who is to be found guilty, and he is told this by the very man who denied the Lusitania the protection she needed. Let me mention one more thing about this, the relationship between the Admiralty and the Lusitania. When the Lusitania got to the South Irish Sea, we know from the Admiralty's records that there were radio transmissions between the Lusitania and the Admiralty. However, the transcript of those transmissions have all gone missing from the Admiralty's files, so we don't know what was said. I should mention this also, and I'm kind of backtracking again, but there are ways that the Lusitania could have been saved besides sending destroyers to escort her. She could have been rerouted around the north of Ireland, where they knew there were no U-boats operating. That would have kept her safe. Or she could have been diverted to the port of Queenstown, like the cruiser Juno, but this was not done. We don't know what the messages said, but in any event, the Lusitania continued on her course. And
straight towards the U-boat.
Captain Turner had no authority on his own to change his course. He was under the control of the Admiralty.
Wow. Well, it sounds like basically the ship was sailed straight into the path of harm's way with predictable consequences.
That is correct. People have said that the U-boat had to be lucky to come across the Lusitania. I suppose that's correct. There's a fair amount of distance between Ireland and England. However, the Lusitania was a huge ship, very tall, with four funnels. Hard to hide, kind of like trying to hide a elephant in your house. But I have to think that there was some means they may have had of knowing the U-boat's location beyond what history books have told us, that they had some way of pinpointing, and it was sent directly into the path. And I say this because of the statements made by British statesmen and our ambassador, Walter Hines Page, who stated that it will happen and that the ship will be blown up. There is tremendous confidence that this incident was going to take place.
Yeah, well, there you have it, folks. It's a false flag. I mean, sure, the Germans sank the ship, but it was the result of an orchestrated event, and the people who benefited from it, the people who orchestrated it, were really not the Germans so much as the other side, just like with Pearl Harbor.
That's correct. And I should mention also, we should probably talk a little bit about the broader context of why they wanted this war and why they wanted America to get into this war.
Sure. Yeah, we only have about 7 minutes left, so let's talk about that.
Okay. I found, Kevin, that wars, when they start a war, it's multidimensional. If you look at 9/11, part of it was to cover up the missing money, but obviously that wasn't all of it. It was also starting wars in the Middle East, but obviously that wasn't all of it. It was also about starting the police state at home. It's multidimensional. World War One was also multidimensional. One objective was to restructure Europe, and so you saw the destruction of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the destruction of the Ottoman Empire, the destruction of Russia, much of the destruction of Germany. And you also saw the creation of the first world government, which we know is a big time goal of theirs. That was the League of Nations, the first formal attempt at a world government. That was Wilson's 14th point of his 14 points. We also saw the Bolshevik Revolution, which we know was funded by the Zionist banksters, the Rothschilds, the Warburgs, Jacob Schiff of Kuhnleib sending Trotsky in after the Tsar abdicated with 20 million in gold. It was also about the Balfour Declaration, of course, 1917, the British government promising Lord Walter Rothschild that Britain would establish a home, Jewish homeland in Palestine in return for bringing America into the war, even though Britain had never been in Palestine, had no authority there whatsoever. It was also, by the way, I think it was partly about distracting people and destroying the reform movement under Robert La Follette, just as the 1898 Spanish-American War distracted people and got rid of the Populist Party.
And just as 9/11 distracted people and got rid of the anti-globalization movement with the Seattle protests.
Yeah, yeah. It's a, wars are a major distraction from our motives towards other objectives. A sixth one was profiteering. After the war, there was a committee of Congress, it was the Graham Committee, issued a 21-volume report based on 3 years of study that found that the banksters led by Bernard Baruch had defrauded the American public out of $6 billion of war munitions that were never manufactured or delivered or had the funds diverted for multinational corporations' own objectives. It was $6 billion. They handed down indictments. They were all quashed. Not one banker went to jail. But profiteering was an element of it, but certainly not the only element. One more was violation of civil rights through the 1917 Espionage Act and 1918 Sedition Act. They actually made it imprisonable by a fine of not more than $10,000 or a jail sentence of not more than 20 years to publicly recommend against sale of U.S. government bonds or loans to the U.S. government or production of war materials. That was included in there. So if you said you objected to war profiteering, you could go to jail for 20 years. And there were people who really
Didn't presidential candidate Eugene Debs actually run for president from his prison cell after he'd been imprisoned for opposing World War One?
I believe that's correct. And of course, our Charles Lindbergh wrote a book called Why Your Country Is at War, and the printing plates were stolen, so he could not have that book published. And Louis Nagler, who was Secretary of State of Wisconsin, got a 20-year sentence for writing a letter against making donations to the YMCA. He said, quote, "There's too much graft in these subscriptions. Not over 10 or 15% of the money goes to the soldiers," unquote. He went to jail. The sale was commuted in 1920, but he got a 20-year sentence, and many other people did. I should mention, not one German spy was ever sentenced under the Espionage Act, only dissenting Americans. I think that the resemblance to the Patriot Act and police state we're facing today are only too clear. So once again, Kevin, the continuity of history.
Wow. That's fascinating stuff. Well, they really did manage to clamp down on the sources of information in that era, even though in some ways I think Americans were better informed in those days. Certainly they knew more about the real struggle for power, which is the struggle of the banksters versus the folks who are not on board with them, which has been going on forever. The monetary question, that was somewhat understood, I think, by a broad cross-section of the American people in the 19th century. And since the coup d'etat of the Federal Reserve in 1913, it seems like that issue has been fully suppressed. But the question is, okay, so they got control of the information machinery pretty much and were able to quash dissent and create false consciousness. Today, however, with the internet, we have a thriving truth movement. People like us are going out and calling it the way we see it, and now huge numbers of people all over the world understand this Bankster New World Order world takeover plan. You think that understanding it will allow us to eventually build a strategy for countering it and putting an end to it?
I hope so. One of my great hopes is that with enough of this information, which is obviously accessible to people in our government, to people in our military, to people in Homeland Security, that there'll be enough people with a good enough heart to realize that they are working for a system that is at its root evil and whose designs are evil and will ultimately mean their own destruction, and that we can find a way to bring this this whole planet back to the kind of thriving free culture that it should be. We want, people always think that in the truth movement we're doom and gloomers, but you know what? To get rid of disease, you got to treat it so you can be healthy again. And that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to make the life healthy for the people, and we need truth to do that. But it is remarkable, and I think they certainly underestimated the intelligence of the average people. I think they look on us as stupid cattle, but in reality, people of the truth movement are quite brilliant. I'm constantly amazed on Twitter and the websites that I visit at the number of people who have woken up and the great job they're doing on YouTube and through other online digital venues of bringing the truth to people. And I'll tell you, the truth is so much more powerful than these dull, vapid lies on CNN.
And it's more interesting, too. And that's why so many people have bought and enjoyed your book, Truth is a Lonely Warrior. That's one of the best-selling truther books of all time. I think you're around 100,000 copies in print or something like that. Congratulations on that. Your other books include Shadows of Power, The Council on Foreign Relations and the American Decline, Tornado in a Junkyard, and The Case Against Darwin. So keep up the great work, James Perloff. We've hit the end of the show. Hope to have you back soon. Keep up the great work.
Thank you so much, Kevin. You're an outstanding truther. I really appreciate your work, and you're giving this opportunity, this venue, to discuss this event. One part of the fabric of evil against mankind.
Okay, we're going to keep fighting it here at Truth Jihad Radio, and so it is James Perloff. I'm Kevin Barrett. Back next time. See you then.
Sad as can be, a message came over the sea. A thousand or more who sailed from our shore have gone to eternity. The Statue of Liberty high must now have a tear in her eye. I think it's a shame, someone is to blame. But all we can do is just die. Some of us lost the truth, sweetheart. Some of us lost the dear dad. Some lost their mothers, sisters and brothers. Some lost the best friend they had. It's time they were stopping this warfare. If women and children must rise. Many brave hearts went to sleep in body when the Lusitania went down. A lesson to all it should be, when we feel like crossing the sea, American ships that sail from our sleep are safer for you and me. A Yankee can go anywhere as long as all glory is there. Although they were warned, the warning they scorned, and now we must try in despair. Some of us lost the truth, sweetheart. Some of us lost the truth. like this war affair with women and children once around.